Chapter 37. Medieval Masonry, where every detail speaks of the dead past, and to think of the events now going on in Paris which must find imitators all over Europe, and which open to the mind such vistas of the future. What a grotesque anachronism is this Gothic castle, built in the same age as that which sees a reforming pope. Yes, but is not the reforming pope himself an anachronism? As a Catholic, here he smiled, intimating that his orthodoxy was not very stringent, I cannot admit that. As a Protestant, you must admit that, if there must be a pope, he must in these days be a reformer, or give up his temporal power. Not that I look on Pio Nono as more than a precursor. He may break ground, and point the way, but he is not the man to lead Europe out of its present slough of despond, and under the headship of the Church, found a new and lasting republic. We want a Hildebrand, one who will be to the 19th century as Gregory was to the 11th. Do you believe in such a possibility? Do you think the Roman pontiff can ever again sway the destinies of Europe? I can hardly say I believe it, yet I see the possibility of such an opening, if the right man were to arise. But I fear he will not arise, or if he should, the conclave will stifle him. Yet there is but one alternative. Either Europe must once more join in a crusade with a pope at the head, or it must hoist the red flag. There is no other issue. Heaven preserve us from both. And I think we shall be preserved from the Pope by the rottenness of the Church, from the drapeau rouge by the indignation and horror of all honest men. You see how the provisional government has resisted the insane attempt of the fanatics to make the red flag accepted as the national banner? Yes, and it is the one thing which dashes my pleasure in the new revolution. It is the one act of weakness which the government has exhibited. A concession which will be fatal, unless it be happily set aside by the energetic party of action. An act of weakness, say rather an act of strength. A concession, say rather the repudiation of anarchy, the assertion of law and justice. Not a bit. It was concession to the fears of the timid, and to the vanity of the French people. The tricolor is a French flag, not the banner of humanity. It is because the tricolor has been identified with the victories of France that it appeals to the vanity of the vainest of people. They forget that it is the flag of a revolution which failed, and of an empire which was one perpetual outrage to humanity. Whereas the red is new, it is the symbol of an energetic, thoroughgoing creed. If it carries terror with it, so much the better. The tyrants and the timid should be made to tremble. I had no idea you were so bloodthirsty, said I, laughing at his vehemence. I am not bloodthirsty at all, I am only logical and consistent. There is a mass of sophistry current in the world which sickens me. People talk of Robespierre and Saint Just, two of the most virtuous men that ever lived, and of Dominic and Torquemada, two of the most single-minded, as if they were cruel and bloodthirsty, whereas they were only convinced. Is it from love of paradox that you defend these tigers? Tigers, again how those beasts are calumniated. He said this with a seriousness which was irresistibly comic. I shouted with laughter, but he continued gravely. You think I am joking. But let me ask you, why you consider the tiger more bloodthirsty than yourself? He springs upon his food you buy yours from the butcher. He cannot live without animal food. It is a primal necessity, and he obeys the ordained instinct. You can live on vegetables, yet you slaughter beasts of the field and birds of the air or buy them when slaughtered, and consider yourself a model of virtue. The tiger only kills his food or his enemies. You not only kill both, but you kill one animal to make gravy for another. The tiger is less bloodthirsty than the Christian. I don't know how much of that tirade is meant to be serious, but to waive the question of the tiger's morality, do you really, I will not say sympathize, but justify Robespierre, Dominic, Saint Just, and the rest of the fanatics who have waded to their ends through blood? He who wills the end, wills the means. A devil's maxim. but a truth. What the foolish world shrinks at as bloodthirstiness and cruelty is very often mere force and constancy of intellect. It is not that fanatics thirst for blood, far from it, but they thirst for the triumph of their cause. Whatever obstacle lies on their path must be removed. If a torrent of blood is the only thing that will sweep it away, the torrent must sweep, and sweep with it all the sentiments of pity, mercy, charity, love. No, these sentiments may give a sadness to the necessity. They make the deed a sacrifice, but they cannot prevent the soul from seeing the aim to which it tends. This is detestable doctrine. It is the sophism which has destroyed families, devastated cities, and retarded the moral progress of the world more than anything else. No single act of injustice is ever done on this earth, but it tends to perpetuate the reign of iniquity. By the feelings it calls forth, it keeps up the native savagery of the heart. It breeds injustice, partly by hardening the minds of those who assent, and partly by exciting the passion of revenge in those who resist. You are wrong. The great drag chain on the car of progress is the faltering inconsistency of man. Weakness is more cruel than sternness. Sentiment is more destructive than logic. The arrival of Schwanthaler was timely, for my indignation was rising. The sculptor received us with great cordiality, and in the pleasure of the subsequent hour I got over to some extent the irritation Berganoff's talk had excited. The next day I left Munich for the Tyrol. My parting with Berganoff was many degrees less friendly than it would have been a week before. I had no wish to see him again, and therefore gave him no address or invitation in case he should come to England. As I rolled away in the Malapost, my busy thoughts reviewed all the details of our acquaintance, and the farther I was carried from his presence, the more obtrusive became the suspicions which connected him with the murder of Lucien Leffelt. How, or upon what motive, was indeed an utter mystery. He had not mentioned the name of Leffelt. He had not mentioned, having before been at Nuremberg. At Heidelberg the tragedy occurred, or was Heidelberg only a mask? It occurred to me that he had first ascertained that I had never been at Heidelberg before he placed the scene of his story there. Thoughts such as these tormented me. Imagine, then, the horror with which I heard, soon after my arrival at Salzburg, that a murder had been committed at Grosseslau, one of the pretty environs of Munich much resorted to by holiday folk, corresponding in all essential features with the murder at Nuremberg. In both cases the victim was young and pretty. In both cases she was found quietly lying on the ground, stabbed to the heart, without any other traces of violence. In both cases she was a betrothed bride, and the motive of the unknown assassin a mystery. Such a correspondence in the essential features inevitably suggested an appalling mystery of unity in these crimes, either as the crimes of one man, committed under some impulse of motiveless malignity and thirst for innocent blood, or as the equally appalling effect of imitation acting contagiously upon a criminal imagination, of which contagion there have been, unfortunately, too many examples. Horrible crimes prompting certain weak and feverish imaginations, by the very horror they inspire, first to dwell on, and finally to realize their imitations. It was this latter hypothesis which found general acceptance. Indeed, it was the only one which rested upon any ground of experience. The disastrous influence of imitation, especially under the fascination of horror, was well known. The idea of any diabolical malice moving one man to pass from city to city, and there quietly single out his victims, both of them, by the very hypothesis, unrelated to him, both of them at the epoch of their lives, when the bosom's lord sits lightly on its throne, when the peace of the heart is assured, and the future is radiantly beckoning to them, that any man should choose such victims for such crimes was too preposterous an idea long to be entertained. Unless the man were mad, the idea was inconceivable, and even a monomaniac must betray himself in such a course, because he would necessarily conceive himself to be accomplishing some supreme act of justice. It was thus I argued. and indeed I should much have preferred to believe that one maniac were involved, rather than the contagion of crime, since one maniac must inevitably be soon detected, whereas there were no assignable limits to the contagion of imitation. And this it was which so profoundly agitated German society. In every family in which there happened to be a bride, vague tremors could not be allayed, and the absolute powerlessness which resulted from the utter uncertainty as to the quarter in which this dreaded phantom might next appear, justified and intensified those tremors. Against such an apparition there was no conceivable safeguard. From a city stricken with the plague, from a district so stricken, flight is possible, and there are the resources of medical aid. But from a moral plague like this, what escape was possible? So passionate and profound became the terror, that I began to share the opinion which I heard expressed, regretting the widespread publicity of the modern press, since, with many undeniable benefits, it carried also the fatal curse of distributing through households, and keeping constantly under the excitement of discussion, images of crime and horror which would tend to perpetuate and extend the excesses of individual passion. The mere dwelling long on such a topic as this was fraught with evil. This and more I heard discussed as I hurried back to Munich. To Munich? Yes, thither I was posting with all speed. Not a shadow of doubt now remained in my mind. I knew the assassin, and was resolved to track and convict him. Do not suppose that this time I was led away by the vagrant activity of my constructive imagination. I had something like positive proof. No sooner had I learned that the murder had been committed at Krasesla than my thoughts at once carried me to a now memorable visit I had made there in company with Berganoff and two young Bavarians. At the hotel where we dined, we were waited on by the niece of the landlord, a girl of remarkable beauty, who naturally excited the attention of four young men, and furnished them with a topic of conversation. One of the Bavarians had told us that she would one day be perhaps one of the wealthiest women in the country, for she was engaged to be married to a young farmer who had recently found himself, by a rapid succession of deaths, sole heir to a great brewer, whose wealth was known to be enormous. At this moment Sophie entered bringing wine, and I saw Berganoff slowly turn his eyes upon her with a look which then was mysterious to me, but which now spoke too plainly its dreadful meaning. What is there in a look, you will say? Perhaps nothing, or it may be everything. To my unsuspecting, unenlightened perception, Berganoff's gaze was simply the melancholy and half-curious gaze which such a man might be supposed to cast upon a young woman who had been made the topic of an interesting discourse. But to my mind, enlightened as to his character, and instructed as to his peculiar feelings arising from his own story, the gaze was charged with horror. It marked a victim. The whole succession of events rose before me in vivid distinctness. The separate details of suspicion gathered into unity. Great as was Berganoff's command over his features, he could not conceal uneasiness as well as surprise at my appearance at the table d'hôte in Munich. I shook hands with him, putting on as friendly a mask as I could, and replied to his question about my sudden return, by attributing it to unexpected intelligence received at Salzburg. Nothing serious, I hope? Well, I'm afraid it will prove very serious, I said. But we shall see. Meanwhile my visit to the Tyrol must be given up or postponed. Do you remain here, then? I don't know what my movements will be. Thus I had prepared him for any reserve or strangeness in my manner, and I had concealed from him the course of my movements. For at whatever cost, I was resolved to follow him, and bring him to justice. But how? Evidence I had none that could satisfy anyone else, however convincing it might be to my own mind. Nor did there seem any evidence forthcoming from Krasesla. Sophie's body had been found in the afternoon lying, as if asleep in one of the bypaths of the wood. No marks of a struggle, no traces of the murderer. Her affianced lover, who was at Augsburg, on hearing of her fate, hurried to Grisesla, but could throw no light on the murder, could give no hint as to a possible motive for the deed. But this entire absence of evidence, or even ground of suspicion, only made my case the stronger. It was the motiveless malignity of the deed which fastened it on Berganov. Or rather, it was the absence of any known motive elsewhere which assured me that I had detected the motive in him. Should I communicate my conviction to the police? It was possible that I might impress them with at least sufficient suspicion to warrant his examination, and in that case the truth might be elicited. For among the many barbarities and iniquities of the criminal procedure in continental states which often press heavily on the innocent, there is this compensating advantage, that the pressure on the guilty is tenfold heavier. If the innocent are often unjustly punished, imprisoned, and maltreated before their innocence can be established, the guilty seldom escape. In England we give the criminal not only every chance of escape, but many advantages. The love of fair play is carried to excess. It seems at times as if the whole arrangements of our procedure were established with a view to giving a criminal not only the benefit of every doubt, but of every loophole through which he can slip. Instead of this, the continental procedure goes on the principle of closing up every loophole, and of inventing endless traps into which the accused may fall. We warn the accused not to say anything that may be prejudicial to him. They entangle him in contradictions and confessions which disclose his guilt. Knowing this, I thought it very likely that, however artful Berganov might be, a severe examination might extort from him sufficient confirmation of my suspicion to warrant further procedure. But knowing also that this resort was open to me when all others had failed, I resolved to wait and watch. X. Finale. Gutenberg Edition. End of chapter.